verse tonight is Psalm 3, and we are going to be, this is a psalm that we have, we were looking at some scriptures before when I did the introduction part 2 a few weeks ago. As we look at Psalm 3, we see that this has a couple of headings to it. Now, the other two we looked at the previous weeks do not have headings to them. They are ones that are called the Orphan Psalms, as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago. But this one has two. And if you remember, we have a potential of 6 different headings to the Psalms. And this one has two, and of course it's the author of the psalm, and then also the occasion of the psalm. Now this occasion that's listed here is from the one time he fled from Absalom, his son, and that whole situation. And a lot of these psalms that have this subscription as far as the occasion is oftentimes hard to match. They're sometimes just hard to figure out what the connection is when it talks about the occasion. But this one is a very easy one. This one is very easy to tell, and it's connected to a very detailed account in the scripture back in 2 Samuel. And as I was looking at this psalm, and I was trying to think, okay, how much detail do I go into as far as the background of this psalm? It was a little bit hard to sort through and know how much I should go through. And I struggled with it a little bit, and I had some time to do it because I was in an airport for quite a while over the last few days because I'd flown out to Montana to see my nephew. And long story short, I spent a lot of time in the airport because there was some delay. So I had a lot of time to go through this and read through this account. That was the background for this psalm. And basically that is found, I'm going to just go through some of the highlights here, and I was trying to pick out which details to even go over because it is such a detailed situation. If you look at the psalm, 2 Samuel, chapter 13, starting in chapter 13, it really goes through 16, but this is, of course, the story of the whole Absalom situation when he had killed his brother because his brother had violated his sister. And, of course, this was an extremely detailed. As I was going through this, I was just remembering as I was trying to pick through all the details, an extremely detailed account of, and complicated account of how, of all the maneuvering that was done with David and his men. His counselor had forsaken him and went with Absalom, and then he had sent spies to Absalom into Jerusalem after he had fled to try to figure out what was going on. And so there's really a lot of detail in this account. So basically, as you look in verse chapter 13, and you look at verse 23, it gives the account here where Absalom had wanted to come back to the king. And he wanted an audience with the king, and he wanted to talk to David, and David had sort of put him off. And so basically, he wanted this audience with the king to be able to talk to him. And then it talks about how Absalom fled, and then it talks about how David's heart in chapter 13, verse 37, it talks about how David had his heart turned toward Absalom. And then chapter 14, Joab, who was David's advisor, thought that this was not a very good idea, so he sent this wise woman to David to try to convince him that perhaps his allegiance or his softening of the heart toward Absalom was not a good idea. And this lady had basically kind of given him the account, sort of like Nathan did, when he had sinned with Bathsheba. She gave him this story, and then it says in chapter 14, verse 13, it said, "The woman said, 'Why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in speaking this word, the king is as one who is guilty, in that the king does not bring back his banished one.'" So basically, the widow is trying to appeal to David in terms of his actions with Absalom. And basically what you have then is Joab has sent this woman, and David asked in verse 18 of chapter 14, it says, "The king answered and said to the woman, 'Please do not hide anything from me that I'm about to ask you.' And the woman said, 'Let my lord the king speak, please.'" And then verse 19 says, "So the king said, 'Is the hand of Joab with you in all of this?' And the woman replied, 'As your soul lives, my lord the king, no one can turn to the right or to the left from anything that my lord the king has spoken. Indeed, it was your servant Joab who commanded me, and it was he who put all these words in the mouth of your maidservant. In order to change the appearance of things, your servant Joab has done this thing. But my lord is wise, like the wisdom of the angel of God, to know all that is on the earth." And then it says, "The king said to Joab, 'Behold, now I will surely do this thing. Go therefore and bring back the young man Absalom.'" And then verse 24, it says, "However, the king said, 'Let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face.' So Absalom turned to his own house and did not see the king's face." And then chapter 14, verse 33, eventually Absalom did come and see the king's face. It says, "So when Joab came to the king and told him, he called for Absalom. Thus he came to the king and prostrated himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom." And then chapter 15, verses 1 through 5, or 1 through 6, discusses basically how Absalom tried to usurp authority by trying to ingratiate himself to the people. He tried to basically take over the kingship by turning the hearts of the people to himself. That sounds kind of like, politicians might do today. And the story talks about how he won over the hearts of the people to him. In verse 4, it says, "Moreover, Absalom would say, 'Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or case could come to me, and I would give him justice.' And when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. In this manner, Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. And so Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel." And then it says, "Now it came about at the end of 4 years," and it says 40 in the New American Standard, and there's some belief that this might be a textual or a copy error, because obviously 40 years wouldn't make sense there. "So it came at the end of 4 years that Absalom said to the king, 'Please let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow while I was living at Geshur in Amram, saying, the Lord shall indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord.' The king said, 'Go in peace.' So he rose and went to Hebron. But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, 'As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you will say, Absalom is king in Hebron.'" So basically it goes on then and talks about how Absalom conspired and basically took over in Jerusalem. And then in verse 13, it says, "Then a messenger came to David saying, 'The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom.' David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, 'Arise and let us flee, for otherwise none of us will escape from Absalom.'" And then it goes on and talks about how David had his people with him, And he had sent some spies. It goes on through chapter 15, how he had sent some spies through back to Jerusalem to try to figure out what was going on. So now, as we go back to Psalm chapter 3, or the third Psalm, we want to read a couple of verses that from that Psalm. And we can really divide this psalm up into four parts, two verses each. The first two verses is the complaint of David to the Lord, verses 1 and 2. And then the second two verses, verses 3 and 4, is the confidence that he expresses in the Lord. And then the third section would be 5 and 6. That says that he sings of his safety in his sleep. And then verses 7 and 8 says, talks about the strength for further conflict. So as we look at verse 1 and 2 and we see the complaint, and we see that that he finally fled from Absalom, he says, "O Lord, how my adversaries have increased." And, of course, we look at that. We can look at right at chapter 15, verse 2 in 2 Samuel, or chapter 12, verse 13, when it says, "Many are they that rise up against me." He is literally using exactly what happened, because Absalom had taken the army, and he had built for himself chariots, and he had turned many of the military people over to himself and their loyalty. And he had even turned David's counselor, Ahithophel, against David. And there was some commentary that suggested that perhaps this was actually the grandfather of Bathsheba, and that there was some thought that he did not feel that David had treated Bathsheba fairly. He had committed adultery with her, and so this perhaps was a reason why this counselor deserted David and turned to Absalom, his son, instead. But David had really experienced here a lot of these people who had turned against him, and so he says, "O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me." And then it says, "Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God." So basically, if we look back again at chapter 16 of 2 Samuel, we see that the Shimei, who was of the family of the household of Saul, came at him in chapter 16, verse 6. Says, "He threw stones at David and all the servants of the king, and all the people and all the mighty men were at his right hand and at his left. Thus Shimei said when he cursed, 'Get out. Get out, you man of bloodshed and worthless fellow. The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son, Absalom. And behold, you are taken in your own evil, for you are a man of bloodshed.'" So here we have an attack on David from one of Saul's house. So basically he is making accusations against David. And he is saying all these things about him. And then, of course, his counselor turns away from him. Who is a grandfather of Bathsheba. So here, this would seem to fit what he is saying. "Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance of God for him in God, Selah." Now, Selah, of course, there's several different thoughts of what this means, but it's usually the most common thought is that it's a pause in a musical point of time, or it's a pause in the musical instrumentation of a psalm. But I remember when I was a teenager, the pastor that was really discipling me, and he would preach, and he would say that this meant, just think of that. Now, I've never seen a commentary since then that has actually used that word in that way. But his interpretation of Selah, or what he had learned, was it was a pause for meditation or a pause for thinking. And we could possibly say with the word Selah, and as a pause here in this verse, just think of that. There's no help. There's no deliverance for him and God. Just think of that. Pause and just think of that. Think about, as David exercises this complaint before God, he is saying, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God. Selah. Pause. Think of that. And then verse 3, we have the confidence that is expressed in the Lord. Even though he had this incredible experience of all these people rising up against him, and even though his own son was leading a revolt against him, he says, but you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the one who lifts up my head. And I like the way the King James puts that, and the lifter up of my head. As we look at this, we see basically three things. We see a shield for those who are defenseless. And of course, the shield here basically looks at a picture of a shield that goes all the way around a person. You know, you are a shield about me or around me. My glory. In other words, in the midst of shame. Of course, we see David. This is a very shameful time. He, of course, had committed adultery. He had basically had his son revolt against him. So he was in a moment or a time of shame in his life, or of embarrassment. But he here is calling the Lord his glory. He's a shield who is defending him against all of these attackers. And he's also his glory in the time of shame. And he is the lifter up of my head. Now, when we think of someone who is downcast, usually their head is down. But this person here is, or God is one who lifts up my head when I am discouraged or when I am down. He is a joy for those who are comfortless. So we have in this very short verse here, defense, glory in the midst of shame, and the lifter up of my head in the midst of discouragement or a need for comfort. And then verse 4, he says, I cried unto the Lord. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain. And of course, when we lift up their voices, now it's interesting that the people who had, we looked at this account of his attacker back in 2 Samuel chapter 16, that these people were lifting up their voices against David. And that is, they were, you know, calling him out, cursing at him. But yet he's saying, I lift up my voice to you, Lord, while those around me may be lifting up their voices against me. I lift my voice to you. And then verse 4 says, the last part of verse 4, and he answered me from his holy mountain. And of course, that is reminiscent of Psalm 15:1 that says, who may dwell in your holy hill? And then verse 40, chapter, or Psalm 43:3, let them bring me to your holy hill. So this is, of course, is a picture of bringing them into the presence of Christ, into his holy place, into his holy habitation. And then chapter 5, and of course we have another pause here, another Selah that basically is inserted in this verse here, or after this verse. So we have the confident, or we have the complaint, verse 1 and 2. We have the confidence in the Lord that is expressed in verses 3 and 4. And then verses 5 and 6, we have the signs of, or the songs of, sleeping and safety. He says in verse 5, I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. Now, it's interesting that David was able to lay down and sleep. Not only, you know, when we say that we have trouble sleeping, we oftentimes have trouble sleeping because of things that we're worried about that might happen to us, or we worry about some thing that may not be provided for us. But here, David's physical safety was in danger. He had his own son revolting against him and had temporarily stolen the kingdom from him. But yet he was able to lay down and sleep. If we just look over in Psalm 4, verse 8, we see, in peace I will both lie down and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me to dwell in safety. So he was singing this song. So it's basically a sleep of presumption. In other words, I can presume that God is going to take care of me, and I can sleep in peace. And basically, David slept with mortal danger all around him. And then his testimony is, and I awoke. And I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. So my sleep was well-founded. I did not have to worry. And basically, he says he's not afraid of 10,000s of people that may set themselves against me round about. If we go back to 2 Samuel again, 2 Samuel chapter 17. It says in chapter 17, verse 1, furthermore, Ahithophel said to Absalom, please let me choose 12,000 men that I may arise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and exhausted and terrify him so that all the people who are with him will flee. Now we learn later on that Absalom also went to Hushai, who had also been sent as a spy of sorts by David. And Hushai basically advised against that particular action. Perhaps David knew that this was going on. And he said, I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. So he acknowledges the great number that is against him, or that could be brought against him. And he says, I will not be afraid of this many people. And he's not just using some type of hyperbole here. He's actually talking here about some perhaps literal 10,000 people that could come and get him or try to sleep to take him out of his, or take his life. And of course, they have set themselves against me round about. They're all around. And then if we go into verse 7, we see that that is a strength for the future. So we see a complaint of the condition in verses 1 and 2. We see in verses 3 and 4 a confidence in the Lord's strength and protection. And then we see in verses 5 and 6 the song of the people who were rising up against him. Then his ability to sleep. And then in verses 7 and 8, we have the strength for the future, or the confidence in the future. It says, arise. Of course, this is a call for action. Arising is sufficient. Basically, arise, O Lord, and save me. For you have smitten all of my enemies on the cheek. You have shattered the teeth of the wicked. Now, the teeth, of course, is oftentimes perhaps thought of in terms of an animal. If we think of an animal is the teeth, and perhaps their claws as well, especially those who are meat eaters, the teeth are a sign of their strength and their viciousness. Now, the idea of shattering the teeth of an animal, especially a carnivore, is that you are destroying their ability to destroy you, or you are destroying the ability of that animal to be able to destroy lives or to be able to eat them. It's kind of funny. We have a Sheltie, and it's a cute little Sheltie, and Patty brushes him every night, and basically oftentimes when he's being brushed and she tries to brush the tangles out of his hair, he doesn't like it because it pulls his hair and it hurts. And he bares his teeth. I mean, he will bare his teeth, and he looks like a wolf. I mean, this cute little Sheltie turns into this wolf-like creature. I mean, he looks completely vicious with these you know, fangs showing. And of course, we've tried to break him from that habit. We've tried different ways of breaking him from that habit. But it's just interesting how he shows his teeth. And what is he doing? He's saying, you know what? I don't like what you're doing to me. And I'm going to show my teeth. You better stop it. But of course, that's the idea there. A dog, you think of a wolf, you know, or you think of a lion, you think of a bear. What does it do? You know, that is their method of tearing people apart if they have to, or tearing their prey apart. And that kind of that picture is here of you have shattered the teeth of the wicked. You know, the teeth of those who are rising up against me. Lord, you have shattered their teeth. You have taken away their ability to do any harm to me. And then verse 8 says, salvation belongs to the Lord. Now, we could probably spend how much time on this one phrase. Salvation belongs to the Lord. And of course, we look at Romans 9:16. And that, of course, is a verse that discusses the salvation of the Lord. Romans chapter 9, verse 16. Well, actually, we can probably back up to 14. What shall we say then? There is no injustice of God, is there? With God, is there? May it never be. For he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy. And I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. So then, it does not depend on the man who wills or the man who runs, but on God who has mercy. So our salvation is of the Lord. And obviously that is a huge statement there of David's confidence in where his protection truly comes from. His salvation or deliverance belongs to the Lord. And so we can say that also today with confidence, that salvation is not of us, but it belongs to the Lord. And then we have a closing with a phrase, your blessing be upon your people. God does not bless the wicked. God does not bless those who are not his. He blesses his people. Your blessing be upon your people. This is a very personal request. This is a very personal, discriminatory type of request. You know, not your blessing be upon those who are wicked. Not your blessing be upon those who are not yours. But your blessing be upon your people. So David is asking here for this. And then, of course, this verse ends with another Selah, another pause, another just think of that. And so we have three Selahs in this short psalm. So we again have our confidence or our complaint, our acknowledgement of the problems that we face. We see the confidence that's expressed in the Lord. We see the testimony of the ability to lie down and have a good night's sleep. And then we have the confidence expressed in God's future deliverance. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Yes.
We'll bring this point up repeatedly as we go through the Psalms, but whenever you look through the any particular psalm, it's good to look back to the themes that we looked over in Psalms 1 and 2, which are like the introduction of the Psalms that sort of set your direction of thinking. Mm-hmm. And you see lots of the themes in Psalm 3 harken back to, oh, there's the way of the righteous. Oh, there's the way of the wicked. I can see that clear delineation there. Oh, I can see how the Lord's blessing is upon the way of the righteous, and how the Lord will truly cause the way of the wicked to perish.
Right.
Oh, I see the way of the wicked is raging against the Lord here, and how he will shatter them, with the same word, he'll shatter them like earthenware vessels, he'll shatter their teeth.
Right.
This is the confidence in the Lord, and then he sums up right at the end with that thematic statement, salvation belongs to the Lord. And you see how that builds upon the concepts that were already laid out in Psalms 1 and 2.
Right.
Again, we'll see that again and again through all the Psalms.
Right. Yeah, and it's how blessed are those who take refuge in him. You know, that's, and then that ends, and this one, your blessing be upon your people. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely true.
I may have missed this because I wasn't here for the beginning, but I think it's good to know that this is towards the end of David's life. Mm-hmm. And he still is confident in the Lord. He's still looking to the Lord. Even though the Lord has helped him to win many victories, he's not now standing on his two feet. You know, he's not feeling like he's arrived at this point and he can make it on his own. In fact, the title, this is when Absalom is trying to overthrow him and he's on the run.
Right.
And so, I think it's good that no matter what stage of life or our spiritual life we're in, we still need the Lord.
That's right. Okay. Anything else? Okay. We done. Thank you.